People continue to be targeted by drone strikes. As late as November, there were two young boys, Jima and Fadi, who were going to collect firewood for their families, who approached the yellow line. They are children, 9 and 10 years old. They did not know what this yellow line was, and they were killed by a drone strike. And this is these are two of hundreds of Palestinians that have been killed by the Israeli military since the ceasefire went into effect.
Finally, do you see this, Maureen, as a ceasefire or not?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Like I said, this is nearly 400 Palestinians have been killed, over 1,000 injured. Palestinians are dying every day in the hospitals due to medical emergencies that could be prevented if they were allowed to have the proper supplies and equipment needed. It is not really a ceasefire. It's just a slower form of death.
And the issue of hunger in the last 15 seconds we have, especially for children.
Children continue to face issues of malnutrition because the Israelis are not letting in the agreed upon amount of aid. The food that is accessible in the market is in through commercial routes, which is extremely unaffordable for families who have been out of work and living under bombardment for 2 years.
Maureen Kaki, I want to thank you for being with us, head of mission for GLIA International, speaking from Khan Yunis, Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, massive flooding from a phenomenon of nature in the Northwest. Our Josh Salem goes in depth. An Oregon community speaks out against putting an ice facility in their backyard. And she's a doctor and Oregon's first female state treasurer, checking in with a barrier breaker. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 11th, 2025. I'm Minette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. In the Northwest, we're in the midst of extraordinarily heavy rains as the result of an atmospheric river. It's a narrow, long corridor in the air that transports massive amounts of water vapor, acting like an actual river. Atmospheric rivers can carry more water than the Amazon. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports, Washington State right now is paying the price, with more to come.
The first of a series of powerful storms dumped heavy rain in the Pacific Northwest earlier in the week, swelling rivers, closing roads, and prompting high water rescues. Residents of both Oregon and Washington faced power outages, flooding, and school closures, and drivers dealt with debris and water that closed roads and even submerged vehicles. Yesterday, a new wave of heavy rain swept into western Washington, leading residents to prepare to flee water coming from rising rivers. A Pacific Northwest atmospheric river has swelled rivers toward record levels, with major flooding expected in areas north of Seattle. Authorities already warned all residents who live within the Skagit River's floodplain to be ready to evacuate. Mount Vernon Mayor Peter Donovan said, quote, "We're preparing for what increasingly appears to be a worst-case scenario here," end quote. Southeast of Seattle, water was waist-deep in Ording, Washington. Part of that town was ordered to evacuate over concerns about the Puyallup River's extremely high levels. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson declared a statewide emergency yesterday, saying, quote, "Lives will be at stake in the coming days." And hundreds of Washington National Guard members will be sent to help individual communities. River levels are expected to be record-setting by several feet. Mount Vernon completed a wall in 2018 to help protect the downtown from flooding, but officials remain concerned as the city sits in a floodplain. Authorities in Washington have knocked on doors to warn residents of potentially imminent flooding in certain neighborhoods. And parts of Interstate 5 between Seattle and Portland already flooded, prompting rescues by firefighters. In Chehalis, a family of six was rescued from their home, with the road being covered by about 4 feet of water. Governor Ferguson said, quote, "I want to encourage all Washingtonians to listen carefully to alerts from your county and emergency management departments. If you receive an evacuation order, please follow that order. It's critical to your safety," end quote. Another storm system is expected to bring more rain starting Sunday. Leaders say, quote, "The pattern looks pretty unsettled going up to the holidays," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
In Lincoln County, Oregon, more than 100 people packed a Waldport City Council meeting Wednesday night to express opposition to even the possibility of an ICE detention facility in the small coastal city. KBOO's Brian Bayhuth was there and files this report.
Waldport City Manager Dan Cutter confirmed a week of swirling rumors that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, had indeed contacted the LC Resort to inquire about renting space at the hotel. It comes as the federal agency has made similar inquiries just up the road in Newport. The council then unanimously passed a resolution that empowers Cutter to use all legal means at his disposal to prevent an ICE detention facility from coming to the coastal community of 2,000 residents.
Preventing a lawful business from operating can be very challenging. We are going to have to be very careful, though very doggedly determined, to do this.
In recent months, the Waldport city government has been plagued by deep divisions and rancor. Following the meeting, Waldport Mayor Heidi Lambert acknowledged the unifying power of opposition to ICE.
The best day of me being mayor just happened right now. We just passed Resolution 1328. Which says that Waldport will not tolerate nor withstand ICE facilities, employment, anything to do with Homeland Security in our city limits. And it was really exciting after hearing 16 public comments. We were all in support. There was no one in opposition.
The city manager said he's concerned that the LC Resort could be in financial trouble and that ownership is inclined to take ICE's offer, whatever that may be. Next step are uncertain for the city as they better understand their legal options. For KBOO, I'm Brian Bayhuth.
Dr. Elizabeth Steiner is Oregon's 30th state treasurer. She's the first woman and the first physician elected to hold this office. Steiner served in the state senate for 13 years before being elected treasurer. Recently, she spoke to Portland City Club about how her work as a state treasurer dovetails with her life's mission, saving and improving the lives of Oregonians.
Let me talk briefly about why in the world I chose to leave full-time medicine and first go into the legislature and then move into this new role as treasurer. Fundamentally, as a family physician in active practice, maybe I see 20 patients in a day and affect their health. And if I'm in the office 4 days a week, that's 80 people. And over the course of the year, it's under 2,000. And the reality is that by doing things like raising the legal age for tobacco and e-cigarettes to 21, that will prevent more illness and save more lives than I could in four full-time careers as a family physician, right? Now, practicing medicine is wonderful, and I was honored to be able to do that for all these years, and I need to update my bio because I'm now an emeritus professor, but whatever, because I retired when I took this job. But fundamentally, as treasurer, one of the things that the treasurer is really charged with doing in a whole bunch of different ways is helping Oregonians build financial security. And I think everyone can agree that without financial security, if you aren't financially well, it's impossible to be physically and psychologically. If you are worried about whether you're going to be able to put food on the table, pay rent, pay utilities, and put gas in your car simultaneously, it's going to be really hard to get enough sleep, to get some exercise, to spend time with your kids to help them thrive in school, to do all the things that we know help people thrive in their own lives. And so as treasurer, I have the opportunity in a lot of different ways to help Oregonians across the state build financial security and therefore improve their health. I really consider myself the de facto chief financial empowerment officer of the state, in addition to being officially the state chief investment officer and in charge of debt management and all the other things. I love this work. This is far and away the best job I've ever had. No, I'm not kidding. I really am not. I work with incredibly talented people every single day. We did a big strategic organizational analysis earlier this year. We had incredible response rate when you ask your employees to do surveys. Sometimes you're lucky if you get to 40%. We were above 60, so I was pretty pleased with that. And overall, our ratings in pretty much every area are 10 to 15% higher than any other state agency because we have a group of people who understand that at Treasury we are committed to serving Oregonians and to building a culture where that commitment to customer service is there every single day and where people understand how their work has an effect on themselves, their neighbors, and people across our great state. So we're doing really well. We do some very direct things. Our unclaimed property division has sent back $14 million in what we call checks without claims. People didn't even have to put a claim in. And by the way, if you have not recently gone to unclaimed.oregon.gov, you should, and tell your friends and neighbors about it, because that's the way we get your money back to you that we are holding in trust. The bank account you forgot about, the check you didn't cash from a business, all of those things are still yours. And we hold them for you until you claim them. And we want them to go back to you. We've had a really busy year. We had a big budget, which increased our budget by 14%, our staff by 11%, largely in the investment division to help us implement our other big triumph, which is the Climate Resilience Investment Act, which says, in the context of our fiduciary responsibility, when possible, we should be moving toward climate positive investing. Now, that's just smart investing, right? Because we all know that there is an energy transition happening, and it's only going to accelerate over time as our energy needs grow and as fossil fuels become less and less realistic as a way to power electricity in our country. And so moving toward climate positive investing and helping our portfolio in that regard is going to be really important. To do that, we needed staff, so we got a bunch more folks in our investment division. We got more folks in our unclaimed property division because, lo and behold, people are recognizing that we can, in fact, get their money back to them. And so we're actually a little bit slower than we'd like to be at getting money back now because more people are turning in their stuff. We do really well at debt management. This year, in April, in the course of 1 week, we issued $2 billion in general obligation and lottery bonds. And we did so successfully, and at such a discount because our bonds are so well received, that we saved $100 million in debt service over the life of the bonds. That's not nothing, right? That's money that can go toward schools or healthcare or public safety or any number of other things that we need general fund for. So that's pretty exciting. We're moving forward. Our 529 accounts are now called Embark accounts because we want people to understand that they are there to help people embark on a lifetime of learning opportunities. And then it's not just for college, but for almost any kind of post-high school education. Because being a diesel mechanic is a great job. You can't offshore diesel mechanics, but it costs money to go to school to be a diesel mechanic, to buy the tools you need, to cover your living expenses. 529 accounts or Embark accounts can be used for those things as well. So those are some of the things we've been working on this year. We passed the nation's landmark legislation to manage cryptocurrency as part of unclaimed property, and it's really being held up as a model nationwide. So we're in the process of implementing that.
In the aftermath of the federal government shutdown and what many call ongoing federal threats against the environment, the Oregon League of Conservation Voters held a town hall. It featured Oregon senior U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, who the group says has been a champion for clean energy tax credits, climate, and the environment. Here's part of what he shared with a group of Oregonians.
The political system in America today feels very broken. And we know it's not, but Donald Trump has done so much to break it, we have to figure out ways to deal with it. And my own view is that in the Trump age, political change is never going to start at the top and then trickle down. It's going to be just the opposite. It's going to be grassroots up. And I think that's what's good about today's discussion. We're going to get a chance to talk about some substantive issues and particularly figure out how we can mobilize grassroots support. I want to mention one thing that's a little bit different. I've written a book, and the book is called It Takes Chutzpah. And what I thought I'd do is just tell you for free what it's about, because I think there's some lessons for everybody who's doing grassroots organizing. First is, if you want to make change, you've got to make noise. And that's something OLCD has always felt strongly about. Second, you got to come to play every day. People know that I went to school on a basketball scholarship, but it's more important than now than ever before because of the challenges and the money that we're up against. And second, there are two paths to progress. Start good things and stop bad things. And I think if we build on those kinds of ideas, we can pick our passion, we can drill down, and we can go after it as OLCD has done over the years. And I look forward to working with everybody on it.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, and he was asked about what his thoughts are with the upcoming midterm elections.
Trump took a big drubbing in New Jersey and Virginia and Mississippi, and he's lost in Wisconsin. I just want, with all of the breakage going on around us and all the damage to healthcare and the environment and core democratic principles, the most important thing we can do is make sure that nobody says, it doesn't matter, it doesn't make a difference, I'm going to set this one out. We've got to be mobilizing now to have maximum kind of turnout, maximum involvement, and that's what I'd say probably tops my list of concerns today. I am America's first mail-in United States Senator in 1996 when I won the first new election in 30 years. That's how we voted. Gordon Smith was the person that I defeated. To his credit, he was pushed hard to say, oh, there'd been fraud, it'd been tainted and all the rest. He said, nope, Ron won the election. Gordon Smith came back in the fall of that very same year, and he won the election. So Oregon had two United States senators in the same year win in vote-by-mail elections. And clearly, we're dealing now with the phenomenon where Donald Trump will go out of his way to say preposterous things in his arguments to try to get rid of vote-by-mail. The first thing that was absolutely bizarre was he said that he had been talking to Vladimir Putin about the need to get rid of vote-by-mail. Now, I can think of a lot of subjects that one wouldn't want to talk to Vladimir Putin about, but the idea that he's going to eliminate a democratic process when Putin is doing nothing except the opposite in Russia takes a special place in the annals of absurdity. What I'm working on with the Vote at Home Act is to take the vote-by-mail effort nationwide, to take it to every nook and cranny. We're obviously not going to pass it this year, but we're going to stay at it until we get it done. Just this week, you may have heard that Senator Merkley and I were able to get the Coast Guard to return the helicopter to Newport. I hope everybody heard about it. It's good news for the Central Coast. But I'm especially proud of the fact that one of the key elements in getting that done is I had a town hall meeting at Newport a few days before Senator Merkley and I were on the phone, me for the second time with the Coast Guard. But I had more than 500 people in Newport during the holiday period all talking about why this was so important. So Exhibit A, folks, if you want to talk about real change, is just what went on in Newport here in the last couple of weeks. And it really began with an open-to-everybody town hall meeting of more than 500 people. Now, I've held 1,138 of these town hall meetings during the time that I've been in the Senate. And people always say, why do you come? In fact, somebody said there are more cows and there are people here, Ron. Why are you coming? And then somebody else piped up and said, I bet the cows aren't for you either. But the point really is the founding fathers didn't think we were just supposed to phone it in. The founding fathers said you had to show up, you had to listen. And that's what I think is the most important part of your question is you probably could conclude, if you're watching this program, watching this discussion, that Senator Merkley and I agree with you on a great many issues. So why would you have to say anything? Why would you register your opinion? The fact is, if you do agree, you still have to participate because we need to know what kinds of nuances go into your position. How do you explain it to other people? What are you hearing? It's an iterative process. Democracy is not linear where you just go from point A to point B and then you call it a day. It's ongoing. You have to be part of it continually, and that's why your involvement is so important. My wife came to town hall meeting number 1000 and she got blocked in the picture. So I said, we'll make sure we correct it in town hall meeting number gazillion.
And Senator Wyden says there is one big issue that's on his mind right now when it comes specifically to the environment.
First of all, the endangerment finding has survived challenges before, and all of us are working to see if we can make that continue. What I can tell you is the idea that greenhouse gas emissions endanger human health and the environment has been upheld in the court now for decades. And what's troubling is the EPA's decision to review the finding, to me, is just political interference, plain and simple. So what we have to do is go to every possible decision-making body and make the case that this would be a disastrous state of affairs to have the endangerment finding in particular not surviving. We've got to keep it. It's incredibly important. Now, we don't know where in the court system it'll end up, and that's something else we're going to have to follow. But it's my intention, I'm sure my colleagues who feel likewise, to keep you abreast of all the relevant information so that every day, if we get more information, we can continue to make the case about why endangerment finding has survived and why it's so important and continues.
And again, that was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden speaking at a town hall meeting with the OLCC. U.S.-Venezuela tensions escalate with the military seizure of an oil tanker. That story, much more, is coming up here in the look at our issues facing our democracy. Here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela. Large tanker, very large. Largest one ever seized, actually.
After the U.S. seized an oil tanker off Venezuela, President Donald Trump said America will keep the oil on board, citing sanctions on the vessel for Iranian oil trading under a previous name. The move is increasing already high tensions with a carrier group deployed there and special forces striking alleged drug boats. The administration says they want to oust Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Officials close to Maduro report he's considering leaving in 2027, though observers say that's likely not soon enough for Trump. The New York Times reports the Pentagon is drawing up plans to kill or capture him. The Senate is preparing to vote on the GOP's health care plan. It would increase funds for health savings accounts Americans could use with the lowest tiers of insurance under the Affordable Care Act. It also gives people options to buy those low-premium plans with less coverage and higher out-of-pocket costs. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says unlike the ACA, this plan will make health care affordable again.
The proposal we'll put out there will bring insurance premiums down, it will be fiscally responsible, and it'll get us away from the practice of giving the money all to the insurance companies and put it back in the hands of the patients.
But experts say the Republican plan doesn't provide enough assistance to make plans affordable. Without pandemic-era subsidies set to expire at the end of the year, average premiums on an ACA plan will more than double. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the GOP bill is, quote, junk insurance.
The bill not only fails to extend the tax credits, it increases costs, adds tons of new abortion restrictions for women, expands junk fees, and permanently funds cost-sharing reductions.
The House has passed the $900 billion National Defense Authorization Act. Despite bipartisan support, this year's huge defense budget faces opposition over specific items added or left out, some even coming from other federal agencies. Jennifer Homendy with the National Transportation Safety Board opposes a provision reversing safety standards put in place after a mid-air collision earlier this year in Washington, D.C.'s airspace.
We should be working together in partnership to prevent the next accident, not inviting history to repeat itself by recreating the same conditions that were in place on January 29th.
Texas college students and professors told a House Democratic caucus meeting that Republican-backed anti-DEI bills at the state legislature are a threat to free speech and academic freedom. UT Austin professor Karma Chavez says a lot of students tell her they plan to leave the state right after graduation because they don't feel safe.
Hostility to academic freedom translates to hostility to creatives, truth lovers, innovators, and pioneers. And we will be left paying the bill of an investment into potential that we have abandoned because we have also abandoned academic freedom and free speech.
Chavez says after one student mocked the death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, Governor Greg Abbott called for their expulsion and others called for the, quote, ninja to face a firing squad or use, quote, strange fruit tactics to make blacks afraid again. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Starting this past October, a new law significantly expanded the sales tax in Washington state to cover more services. Washington relies heavily on sales taxes, which in cities such as Seattle and Tacoma is higher than 10%. But now, as Isabel Charlet reports, there's a push to tax Washington's wealthy and rebalance the scales.
Washington state is entering the new year with an estimated revenue shortfall of $11 billion. In response, advocates for working families are urging the state to generate new revenue by raising taxes on its wealthiest residents. Research shows Washington has the second most regressive tax system in the country, with low and middle income residents paying upwards of 14% of their income to taxes, while the wealthiest pay just 4%. Emily Vananek with the Washington State Budget and Policy Center says the state needs a more progressive tax system, explaining it's not about politics, rather it's an attempt to rebalance the scales.
Washington already gives preferential treatment to wealthy people and wealthy corporations, and that was doubled down on at the federal level. And so how do we pay for the services and programs that people use as lifelines, frankly, when we're asking people with the least to pay the most?
Critics argue that progressive taxes drive away wealth, but Vananek says that is not true, noting that Boeing moved more than 1,000 jobs out of the state after receiving one of the largest tax breaks in U.S. history. H.R. 1, which passed this summer, severely cut essential programs such as Medicaid and SNAP while giving large tax cuts to the wealthy. The richest 1% in Washington will receive more than 60% of the federal tax cuts, averaging more than $103,000 a year, according to the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. David Henson with the nonprofit Firelands Workers Building Community Power says the state has no choice but to find a new source of revenue.
I would like to actually see a common sense approach to the funding for our taxes. We're not doing that. They make more money than we do. They should pay their fair share.
Vananek says there is progress, citing Washington's 2021 passage of the Working Families Tax Credit, as well as a capital gains tax, which taxes revenue from stocks and bonds more than $250,000 to fund education and child care. In its first few years, it has generated more than $1.2 billion. Vananek calls it a sustainable revenue source, but says more work remains.
Even though those were really big policies, they weren't moving the needle as massively as we need to if we're actually going to address affordability in our state.
Vananek explains that more than half of Washington's budget relies on the state's sales tax, which does not take the income of consumers into account. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A new app is going to allow generations of Cherokee to connect with their culture and history. Brian Bull from Eugene, Oregon, has today's edition of National Native News.
In Tahlequah, Oklahoma this week, Cherokee language speakers and officials unveiled a Cherokee language dictionary app. They were joined by representatives of Kiwa Digital Limited, who developed the app based on a Cherokee dictionary 50 years ago, created by native speaker Durbin Feeling. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. said the new app will allow every Cherokee family to carry the resource in their pockets and represented the tribe's sovereignty and knowledge, as well as their commitment to keep the Cherokee language strong for generations to come.
For the last 5 centuries, our language and our culture has been under assault, has been eroded, and that's the story of indigenous languages around the world, many of which are part of history books about languages that once were.
Hoskin said he expected the app to become more than a simple curiosity for tribal members and will be especially embraced by children and other youth. The Cherokee Language Dictionary app includes translations for more than 6,000 Cherokee words with audio recordings, grammar notes, and phonetics. In September, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave an unusual speech to top brass in which he rallied against woke ideology and hyped the recently rebranded Department of War. He also weighed in on a long simmering controversy involving the so-called Battle of Wounded Knee, which occurred on December 29, 1890, where hundreds of Lakotas were killed by the U.S. Army. Many consider that conflict a massacre and have called for the soldiers to be stripped of their medals of honor. Hegseth dismissed the idea as political correctness run amok and released a video defending the soldiers and their medals. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it was a painful message for tribes throughout the country.
Under my direction, we're making it clear without hesitation that the soldiers who fought in the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890 will keep their medals.
Although bipartisan efforts in Congress to rescind those medals go back decades, only a president has the legal authority beyond the Pentagon itself to undo that distinction.
This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate. We salute their memory, we honor their service, and we will never forget what they did.
In what would be the final chapter of the Army's century-long Indian Wars campaign, as many as 300 Lakotas were killed at Wounded Knee in South Dakota, while at least 25 U.S. soldiers died. A rifle shot rang out when troops tried disarming a surrendering encampment on December 29, 1890. In that confusion, the mass slaughter of mostly unarmed men, women, and children ensued. Army General Nelson Appleton Miles penned in private, quote, "I have never heard of a more brutal, cold-blooded massacre than that at Wounded Knee." To this day, there is still no official death count. Hegseth's comments came a few weeks after President Trump signed an executive order rebranding his agency as the Department of War.
This is something we thought long and hard about. We've been talking about it for months, Pete and I, and I think it's a much more appropriate name, especially in light of where the world is right now.
From the Russian invasion of Ukraine to the Israeli-Hamas conflict in Gaza, the same dynamics of Wounded Knee, of civilians being killed by conquering military forces, continue